Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Obamacare survived the Supreme Court and Republicans in Congress. Good old-fashioned economics? We'll let you know. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, the 16th of August, it is good as always to have you along, everybody. The underlying business fundamentals make sense. You lose money, you stop doing whatever it was that was losing you money. But Aetna's decision to pull out of local healthcare exchanges in 11 of the 15 states where it is currently in that marketplace presents a fundamental challenge to the business model that was supposed to make the Affordable Care Act work. Other big insurance companies have scaled back as well, but Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports now from the health desk at WHYY. Reports of Obamacare's demise might be greatly exaggerated.
Make no mistake, this is a bad day for Obamacare.
Aetna's decision has a direct effect on competition in many parts of the country, and it's a bit of a red flag for the future.
Larry Levitt is with the Kaiser Family Foundation. An analysis from Kaiser shows, as of today, people in about a quarter of all counties will only have one option. There's even one county in Arizona with nothing. That won't raise prices for most consumers, but the quality of the coverage could slip. Aetna, like United Health, Humana, and others, says it's pulling out because it's losing too much money. There are just not enough healthy people paying in to cover the cost of so many sick people.
Plans who have been in the market have learned some tough lessons.
John Burko is the head actuary for California's exchange. He says many of the big insurers offered too much at first.
Most, but not all, of the big five are incompetent at creating good narrow networks.
Smaller insurers, companies used to working with low-income patients and tight networks of docs and hospitals, appear to be making money. Since Obamacare's always been controversial, it's often hard to figure out the difference between the hype, the hate, and the hope. The federal official who oversees the exchanges, Andy Slavitt, says the dire predictions over Obamacare's demise go way too far. This, he says, is just a new market shaking out.
Everybody launching into this new market without a lot of data made their own assumptions, and now they're spending time adjusting to those assumptions.
Slavitt says nervous insurers should take a hard look at the companies who are making money. He's confident there's money to be made. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
The unprecedented flooding in parts of Louisiana continues today. Governor John Bel Edwards says more than 20,000 people have had to be rescued. Tens of thousands of homes are at risk. It is historically bad down there. But using words like historic and unprecedented could start to be tricky when we talk about rain and floods, because we're going to be using those words a lot. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Jed Kim explains.
The news sounds terrible.
Tonight, a desperate rescue effort for a growing catastrophe. Now more than 7,000 people in Louisiana rushed to dry land.
Terrible, but could it also be sounding familiar? This from Houston just 4 months ago.
This morning, a city submerged by historic flooding. 17 inches in a matter of hours.
If it feels like there's more of these kinds of storms happening these days,
the short answer is yes, they have been increasing.
David Easterling is a research climatologist with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. He says they've been increasing for the past 60 years. Global warming is making it worse.
As the air temperature increases, then we have a greater capacity to hold moisture in the atmosphere. And so we do see these heavier rainfall events occurring even more often in the future.
With those rains, there's the need to manage the water. Eric Halpin is with the Army Corps of Engineers. He oversees more than 3,000 dams and levees. Most are 50 or 60 years old.
They were designed for the events and, frankly, the population of a couple of generations ago.
In its latest report card, the American Society of Civil Engineers gave all of the nation's dams and levees a D and D minus, respectively. Upgrading them won't be cheap.
Just within the Corps of Engineers, you're talking about tens of billions of dollars.
Still, Halpin says the cost is worthwhile.
The choice for the country really is to either invest on the front end in these preventative measures. So it's safety programs where you're evaluating the risk and acting on it ahead of time, or to live in a disaster relief environment.
Some cities are investing in prevention. Houston's mayor recently appointed Stephen Costello to be the city's chief resilience officer.
Prior to 2010, the city was spending about $100 million on street and drainage improvements annually. Today, we're spending almost $300 million.
He says that will probably double over the next decade. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
With the statistical preface that the federal government spends more than $150 billion a year to help students pay for college, grants and loans and work-study funds, from the Obama administration today, then, this item, a new kind of training program, one you don't have to be a student to get access to. $17 million to be spent mostly at for-profit companies, including coding boot camps and a GE jet engine plant. And yes, $17 million may be relative pennies, but Marketplace's Amy Scott reports from the education desk at WYPR. That's what pilot programs are.
Since 2012, the Flatiron School has turned out about 1,000 graduates of its coding boot camps. The company charges $12,000 to $15,000 for 3 to 5 month courses. Pricey, but
if you're not employed within 6 months, we will give you a full refund.
Co-founder Adam Enbar says 98% of Flatiron's graduates land jobs, mostly as software engineers, making an average $74,000 a year. Under the new experiment, the school will partner with the State University of New York. About 30 students to start will be able to earn college credit and certificates in web development and pay for it with federal grants and loans. Enbar says the program represents a shift in thinking.
While college is certainly a great way to achieve a higher education, there are other ways to attain a higher education that can lead to a great career that are not that system.
Other providers include Straighter Line and Study.com, companies that offer inexpensive online courses. GE is teaming up with Northeastern University to offer training in advanced manufacturing. Analyst Howard Lurie with the research firm EduVentures says until now, these programs have only been available to people who could pay.
I think what this does is expand the potential pool of people who could benefit from that type of immersive experience.
Expanding access to federal financial aid for for-profit companies is raising some eyebrows, but Undersecretary of Education Ted Mitchell says they'll be heavily monitored and that the department cares less about tax status than about outcomes. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Wall Street was down all day, down from there at the close. Details, numbers, you know the drill. When you think of the modern-day talent agent, to the extent, granted, that you do, it's probably a version of the Ari Gold character from Entourage, right? The always-looking-for-a-deal-do-anything-to-keep-your-star-client-happy talent agent. Turns out that's not far from the truth. The modern talent agent is largely a creation of the past 40 years in that industry, a four-decade span that saw the creation, the stumble, and then the return to prominence of Creative Artists Agency, CAA for short. Was founded by five guys in 1975, including Michael Ovitz and Ron Meyer, who got fed up with the old guard at William Morris and wanted to do something new. James Andrew Miller has a new book out. It's an oral history of that company called Powerhouse, the untold story of Hollywood's creative artists agency. Jim, it's good to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me about Mike Ovitz, because he and Ron Meyer are the two protagonists here.
Right. So Ovitz is, you know, he is a complex figure. When the agency was formed in 1975, he was the youngest and least experienced. And yet, within the decade, he was being touted as the most powerful man in Hollywood. So what you're talking about is a guy who never slept, was incredibly driven, and was quite, not to stereotype a word, but, you know, Machiavellian about the way he went about business.
Great, a lot of great stories about Michael Ovitz in this book. One involves Michael Eisner and Eisner's wife. After they have a very early interaction, Ovitz and Michael Eisner do.
Right. This was like one of those little delicious nuggets you come upon and you didn't realize it, because obviously Ovitz left CAA in 1995 to become president of Disney under the chairman of the board, Michael Eisner. But it turns out that in the beginning, Michael Eisner had gone to a game show that Ovitz was representing. And on his way out, when Ovitz asked him, did you like it? Eisner just casually said, you know, I don't know, but my wife loved it. And Ovitz wound up sending a dozen roses to Eisner's wife. Just shows the kind of chutzpah that Ovitz had during those days. And Eisner told me that, you know, one of the first things he said to Ovitz was, you know, don't send any more roses to my wife.
And he says, don't agent my wife.
Don't agent my wife.
I love that use of agent as a verb, because that sort of goes to what these guys do. And, well, and some women eventually as well, but in the beginning.
And they can't turn it off. I mean, one of the things that I understood going into this process, which was kind of fun, was, you know, people out here telling me, wait till you see how they agent you. And it is something that I think it's a skill set that you develop and you become very good at. And then it becomes part of the fabric of your life. So you don't know when to turn it on or when to turn it off.
There's a great line from a whole passage, actually, from Eva Longoria about what CAA has done for her. They repped her as an actress, and then she wanted to start doing projects, so they hooked her up with their producer-director division and then the writer division. Run me through the services that CAA provides.
It's no longer enough for these agencies to just talk about a TV part or a movie part. A lot of actors and actresses want, and they use the word, their brands. And just a little postscript that says something about the kind of crazy world of agenting. When I interviewed Eva Longoria this year about CA and all the things that they do for her, well, lo and behold, in the past month, she's left them.
Oh, no, really?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So,
man, it's cutthroat out there.
It is cutthroat, and there's no real sense of security that these people have. I mean, even, you know, even if you've had a client for like 10, 15 years, it can just disappear like that.
They're not just talent agencies now.
No, not at all. The fact is that these are big corporations that have worldwide presence. I mean, CAs in China and India, and so we have to stop thinking of them as these, you know, shops where, you know, Morty's sitting there with a cigar and his feet are up on the desk and say, come on, let's do this deal for, you know, so-and-so.
Since you brought the throwback into this, let me close where we started. Where are Michael Ovitz and Ron Meyer right now?
Ron Meyer is chairman of Universal Studios. He's now survived six owners. Comcast owns Universal over 21 years. So he's been at Universal longer than he was at CA. And, I mean, the guy is a walking Switzerland. He seems to get along with everybody. And Michael Ovitz is...
Who doesn't get along with everybody, right?
Right, yeah. Right. And he's very involved with Silicon Valley and acts as a investor and entrepreneur.
It's a book called Powerhouse about the creative artist agency CAA. James Andrew Miller wrote it. It's absolutely fascinating. Jim, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up.
A lot of folks, when we started, thought that it was a bad idea. Well, they were wrong.
Shaving and some of the issues of this society. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 84 points on this Tuesday, 0.4%, 18,552. The NASDAQ down 34 points, 0.6%, 5227. The S&P 500 gave up 12 points, about a half percent, 2178. If you wear a uniform at work, it might well come from the Cintas Corporation, especially now that Cintas is buying competitor G&K Services for nearly $2 billion. Cintas up 5% today, G&K up 17%. Shenandoah Telecommunications gained 5.6% today after an analyst upgrade. If you're a customer, you know it as Shentel. Telephone and Data Systems, Inc., think TDS, off 2% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.57%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Imagine for a minute your job involves trading or investing millions, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars, probably somebody else's money, too. Imagine the stress, the professional anxiety, the way everything could go south in a very big hurry. Enter now the Wall Street Performance Coach. They are a real thing, first of all, and they are also not hurting for business. Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
John Netto had early aspirations to be a trader.
I knew what I wanted to do at the age of 12 when I saw the movie Wall Street.
He got his wish in the late 90s after being in the Marines for almost a decade, but he had a problem. He was trading for himself, and he wasn't pulling in enough money.
You know, if you make a big market call and instead of making $100,000, you make $6,000, like, okay, maybe it's unrealistic to make $100,000, but you should be making between 30 and 50.
He was not. So he sought out a performance coach. Now, he thought this coach would work on his trading strategy. Instead, she asked about his feelings as he moved in and out of trading positions and about his childhood. Neto's dad had been all about academic achievement, and Neto barely graduated high school. He says he came to realize his dad's disappointment, it was affecting his trades.
If I don't believe that I'm truly intelligent, how can I believe that I have an edge in the market?
He says making that connection was the start of a turnaround. Denise Schull, his first coach, is a former trader herself. She also has a master's in neuroscience and psychoanalytic theory. She says there's always an underlying reason for trading behavior. Take a guy she coached several years ago.
Who came because he lost money every morning and then made it back and was profitable, but had been doing this for years. Because it makes no sense. You know, why do I have to start every morning down?
It turns out when he was a kid, his family had barely scraped by. In his teens, he got a running coach, did really well, and began to climb out of poverty. She says he was repeating his life story in a day's trades.
In fact, the next month after we put that two and two together, if you will, he made more than three times what he'd ever made in one single month.
And he kept it up. In fact, she's been so successful, the makers of the recent Showtime hedge fund drama Billions sought her out for advice. In this scene, a trader slumps down in front of his coach. He says he's lost his mojo. After a few questions, the coach has him stand up and repeat the figure he brought in last year.
7.2 million.
Bring it close.
7.2 million.
So what's it saying?
That I'm awesome.
There you go. And what does it have to say back to that loud, critical voice?
You can guess. We can't play it on the radio. Like that fictional coach, psychologist and performance coach Alden Cass says he meets those macho traders where they are. He has them practice what he calls bullish thinking.
We help them identify their irrational, bearish thoughts that are self-defeating in nature. All-or-nothing thoughts like, this bad trade will now ruin me for the month. I'm now going to be wiped out for the year. All my gains are lost. I'll never come back from this.
He uses sports analogies to get clients to forget that last haunting trade.
Just throw the ball as hard as you can. If it's there and you believe in it and you have high conviction, go for it and let it ride. You really have to really believe in yourself.
Trader John Neto agrees self-belief is vital to success. In a way, he wishes more traders and portfolio managers had coaching. Just not right now.
I support this, and I believe everyone should do it. But the longer people take to adopt these types of protocols and procedures, paradoxically, the more beneficial it is to me and my business.
Because he says until then, he has an edge in the market. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
A couple of years ago, we had a guy on the program who had had a job at Foursquare. He'd been an entrepreneur in residence at the high-profile Silicon Valley venture capital firm Andreessen Horowitz as well, but he had moved on to start a company making personal grooming products for people of color, specifically a shaving brand. The person in question was Tristan Walker. The brand was Bevel. The reason, as he told me then 2 years ago, was this.
You know, I reflect back on my experience of going to, you know, a retail shop, you know, and having to get health and beauty products, having to go to the ethnic aisle, right? That's not really an aisle. It's a shelf. Then I have to reach to the bottom of that shelf for a package that's dirty. And then the joke that we like to say internally, you know, there's a photo of like a 65-year-old bald black gentleman in a towel on it, right? Like that entire second-class citizen experience is just, it's not great, right? You know, considering, you know, how much money we spend on these things, how much need we have for products that work, you know, how much purchasing power we have, right? I think having a respect for the customer is incredibly important, right? So this is more than just the products.
It has been a busy 2 years for Tristan Walker and his company, now known as Walker & Company Brand. So we got him back on the phone for today's installment of Conversations from the Corner Office. Tristan Walker, it's good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
First of all, congratulations are in order, I suppose. You have now made it into Target with the Bevel.
Yes, right? We're very, very excited about that. Thank you so much.
Well, and more to the point, you're not, as you like to say, you're not in the ethnic aisle anymore.
Yeah. No, that's always been our dream, right? We wanted to ensure that our products had the dignity or were presented with as much dignity as other products within kind of that aisle. And I think we've succeeded in a very, very big way.
Last time we had you on, we talked a little bit about the
I guess the word is education curve, right? You had to educate people about why your products were needed. And I will say, in full disclosure, you had to educate me. Do you still find yourself having to do that?
Yes, we do. Absolutely, right? And that's why I think selling our products online direct to consumer allow us to do that in ways that a lot of the large incumbents cannot. But what we're finding, which is uniquely interesting, in the retail channel at Target, we're finding an entirely new kind of customer group, right? These are a lot of folks who are trading from the multi-blade razor shaving experience to the new single-blade shaving system experience that we're offering, because a lot of those customers are suffering from the problem that we're solving, shaving irritation.
Do you think, though, now that you have demonstrated some success, that the bigger consumer products companies, specifically, you know, shaving and personal grooming, are they going to look a little closer at you and say,
Yeah, I mean, ever since we started the company, I think they've been looking at us. Look, I mean, at Walker & Company, we have a 150-year vision, right, to build a brand or suite of brands that folks can be proud to support, right? Our vision is incredibly ambitious. We want every single person on the planet to experience a Walker & Company brand, right, where we're solving their unique problems that they're finding in health and beauty, right? We want to build something with as much legacy as a Procter & Gamble, with as much legacy as a Johnson & Johnson and Unilever, and we're not going to stop until we kind of give our all to that stead.
One of the reasons, besides the actual need for the products that you guys sell, one of the reasons that Walker & Company Brands gets the attention and that you get the attention is that you are a black eye in Silicon Valley, of which there are not many. Do you find Silicon Valley and the tech industry receptive to the way you are trying to do what you do?
So, I mean, I kind of start by answering, you know, I think a big reason why we get the attention that we do is because our products work. You know, we get, you know, a lot of folks that really want to talk about my own personal story, but Walker & Company is not about me, and I want to make that kind of clear to all customers. That said, I think Silicon Valley is growing a hell of a lot more amenable to companies like ours because we are proving that there is such a unique need for this thing. If you think about Walker & Company, a lot of folks when we started thought that it was a bad idea. Well, they were wrong. And now they're seeing that there's a significant opportunity to cater to the demographic groups that we're doing in the categories that we're doing it in.
How old are you? 30-something-ish, right?
I just turned 32.
Okay. So you are a young guy. I imagine, though, that you have you have young people of color coming up to you all the time saying, Mr. Walker, how do I do what you did?
Yeah, I mean, they inspire me. Right. You know, I have a not-for-profit also called Code 2040. And we get some of the highest performing black and Latino engineering undergraduates out here and kind of help them succeed in Silicon Valley. You know, they give me so much hope because they're seizing what ought to be. Right. You know, they ought to be here. They ought to be you know, serving their community in ways that they hadn't previously. They ought to participate in the innovation economy. They give me the hope. And I'm very, very thankful for them.
How do you help them reconcile the idea that they have to get by, they have to do business in overwhelmingly white, overwhelmingly male Silicon Valley, and yet still be people of color and focus their attention there, too?
Yeah, I mean, well, I'd say a couple of things. Number one, the fact that I am a person of color is not a weakness. It is a strength. It allows me to observe things that other folks will not, right? And it shows that I have some level of authenticity that a lot of other potential entrepreneurs might not have. You know, understand your strengths, right? Don't worry so much about your weaknesses. And the second thing that I'd say, you know, if you think about inequality or imposter syndrome, like these are choices. I tell these folks, just perform and perform better than everyone else, right? And understand and appreciate your own personal strength as a person of color. And that will go a hell of a lot long way.
As you look around at some of the issues that we are having in this country right now with race and income inequality and economic opportunity, what do you think? You look at this and you say to yourself, Tristan, man, what?
Yeah, I mean, I'm incredibly frustrated. You know, I love this country, right? Only in this country is my story possible, right? And I really do appreciate that. And when I kind of hear some of the things that are, you know, replete in bigotry and misogyny and hear that rhetoric, I get incredibly upset. But I'm also hopeful, you know, when I look at stories like our own, when I look at the stories of other entrepreneurs who are succeeding out here and people of color, we have hope. right? And as long as I continue to have that optimism and hope, you know, I think we'll be in a very, very good place.
Tristan Walker is the founder and CEO of Walker & Company Brands. Tristan, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
We've got the rest of my interview with Tristan Walker on our Corner Office podcast. Subscribe, take a listen, let us know what you think. It is available wherever you like. Final note on the way out today, in which I report that the latest figures on inflation came out this morning. Zip, zero, nada, bupkis, no change to the headline Consumer Price Index July to August. Inflation in this economy is once again dead, it would seem, except that there was a bump of 0.8% from July a year ago, which leads me back to this piece of tape from The Princess Bride, which, yes, I have used before, but it is just too good not to play again.
Well, it just so happens that your friend here is only mostly dead. There's a big difference between mostly dead and all dead.
Okay, wait, there's more. What would that difference be, you ask?
Mostly dead is slightly alive. Now, all dead, well, with all dead, there's usually only one thing that you can do.
What's that?
Go through his clothes and look for loose change.
Which is, if you really stop and think about it, kind of what the Fed's doing, right? Totally is what the Fed's doing, by the way. All right, we got a boogie. It's a little tight. Tommy Andres, Raghu Manavalan, and Vanessa Smith are the producers on our elections desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Nishat Kerwa, Donna Tim, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.